Welcome back to Pit Side from the Plex. Today's show is a little more serious than usual, but it's a topic that I think we need to address and talk about. And we got a little into this when we talked with Tori Huster from the Washington Spirit with everything that's going on in the league. So today we are talking with the CEO for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, Jerise Colon. And she kind of gives us her story. She started working at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children after growing up in Virginia and living through a rash of kidnappings of high school girls. Made her want to work with children and in this area. And she went on from there to work for the Boys and Girls Club of America, writing child safety policy. And then from there is newly named the CEO for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport and all that comes with that. So she gives us a rundown of what exactly the U.S. Center for Safe Sport is, how they came about, what their jurisdiction is, and what their role is in preventing abuse, sexual abuse, mental abuse of athletes for the Olympic sport movement, youth sports, and how it impacts everything all the way down to our recreational soccer league. So it was very insightful, and she has some great knowledge and information, and I think it's a topic that we need to talk more about. So I hope you enjoy the show, and thanks for listening to Jerise Colon from the U.S. Center for Safe Sport.
Welcome to the Pitch Side from the Plex podcast, coming to you from the Adventist Healthcare Fieldhouse at the Maryland Soccer Plex with your hosts, Matt Liver and Kim Walter.
The American Red Cross is facing a national blood crisis. Without more donors, hospitals may be forced to make tough decisions about which patients receive transfusions and who must wait. You can help. No matter your blood type, your donation is critically needed now. Use the Blood Donor app, visit redcrossblood.org, or call 1-800-RED-CROSS to make an appointment to donate blood today.
So welcome back to the show. Today's guest is Jerise Colon from the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, which most people probably don't know what it is. We'll get into that. But first, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. So we'll get into what Safe Sport is first, but let's hear about you. Kind of give us your background, where you're from, where you went to school. Did you play sports as a kid? All those good things.
Sure. So I am actually from Virginia. I grew up in Spotsylvania County, which is about an hour south of D.C.
Fredericksburg, right?
Oh, all right. I love it. And so since you're from Fredericksburg, you remember there was a lot of high-profile abductions that happened in the 90s. And I was in high school when that happened. And it was just something that I watched, and I felt like I was living, right? Because I remember when the police stopped me that day when the List girls were abducted. You know, it just stuck with me. And so when I graduated college, I went to VCU. And when I graduated college, I knew that I wanted to do something. I just didn't know what it was. And then as I was figuring out what to do with my life, I stumbled across the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and NCMEC, which was in Alexandria. I think they relocated to Arlington now, but in Alexandria, but they were the ones who were responsible for putting the pieces together for those abductions and murders. And so it was something that I was like, wow, I could be a part of this. And so I started there right after college. I worked my way up. I started answering phones, which was probably the most difficult job that I've ever had. I worked the night shift, so like 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. And all the phone calls were from parents who were just distraught. Because either they were missing their child had run away, or their kid was involved with some sort of sexual abuse or exploitation. And so I took those phone calls for a long time, and it was just too much for me. And so ultimately I moved on inside the organization, ended up leaving as executive director of outreach and prevention. So I manage all of their educational content, our internet safety program, our outreach. And then left to move down to Atlanta where I was the vice president of Child and Club Safety, managing all of the safety issues for our 4,300 plus locations across the United States and abroad, which was, that was probably the most stressful job I've ever had. and then I came to the center in 2019 to lead the organization in a really transformational time. And, it was my first time being a CEO, so I wasn't really sure what to expect. I wasn't big into sports growing up. I ran track when I was in high school. I was on the dance team. I wasn't good at any of it, but I did show up, which I think is half the battle.
It definitely is.
Right? So, I had some sort of connection.
I always joke with my track and field friends that I don't understand the sport, because in every other sport, when you do something wrong, the punishment is running, and then your sport is just running. And they're like, yeah, we hear that a lot. So, I ran more laps than I ever wanted to for whatever sport I was playing, but I never thought I would do it as a sport itself.
It was fun. It actually got me moving. And I really appreciated, once I went to college and I was like, ooh, I clearly don't move anymore. So I started gaining weight and I was like, oh gosh, I need to go back and run track again. but it was good. It taught me lots of things, right? It taught me how to be part of a team, taught me how to push my limits, because I wasn't a runner when I started. And then I even joined cross country for a bit. And so that was helpful. And so understanding what kids go through when they're going through sport and trying to learn the sport or they're trying to excel at it, mm-hmm. helped me as I was trying to figure out what our direction was going to be at the center. So all of that, I think, kind of came together in this perfect little bubble, which was nice.
So when you were at the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, was there ever a sport piece to that? Did they kind of concentrate in different areas? Did they recognize, because obviously I think sports is one of those things where kids are with people they trust and know, but there's not a lot of, at least back then, there wasn't a lot of background checks being done and things like that. So was that a focus for that center? Did that ever come to your work and kind of led to where you are now?
So loosely, I think it was maybe back in 2006, we launched a program that was all around competition and sport, and really making sure that coaches had the right information to be able to protect kids. But I can't tell you how many reports that we got over the years, particularly through the cyber tip line, that were coaches or teachers or scouting leaders, right, or religious officials that were abusing children. So it was always present. But at that time, I think the work around just prevention around sexual exploitation and abuse was just getting started in the 90s. And there wasn't really a big focus on sport. And honestly, not until the Safe Sport Authorization Act in 2018, and then, of course, the Larry Nassar scandal that put him in jail in 2016, was there really any focus around sports? I think at that time, the nation was really focused around the Catholic Church. They were looking at the schools in their community or Boy Scouts, but nobody was really looking at sports. And it was always there. And I just think that it just took time for people to start focusing on it, which is unfortunate because we got a late start.
Yeah. I mean, that had to be you said it was a tough job to listen to those stories. And I always love to hear the story of how you got into it. And obviously you talked about growing up in Virginia and the missing girls down there. Did you go to school knowing full well, when you went to VCU, was that what you wanted to do?
I actually started out as an engineering student, and I didn't know what I wanted to do.
I mean, it's pretty close to what you're doing.
I was trying to figure, any high school student coming into college, I was just trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I didn't even really know at that time what an engineer did. I don't even know why I chose that field. But I knew immediately, first semester, not for me. But I knew that I wanted to do something that was going to help people. I just didn't know what that was. And so, I tried a bunch of things. I took a bunch of different classes at VCU, and I ultimately settled on criminal justice, not really knowing what I was going to do. I thought about going to law school afterwards. And then I was on a jury actually out in Richmond years ago. And I was like, this is too much power for one person to have. I can't be on a jury. I don't want to be a lawyer. Ironically enough though, now with my current job, I'm surrounded by lawyers all the time. And I get a little lesson every day. So, but yeah, I just wanted to do something that was going to impact people. And I knew that it was going to be around children, but at that point I just didn't know what it was. And then as I was following that story, because it wasn't until I was in college that, the guy was arrested, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was responsible for putting together those pieces to find him. Right. And so I was like, well, that's pretty awesome when you think about like how little information we had. This was before like people had cell phones. There wasn't a lot of internet access. And so they were doing a lot of this just like by old fashioned, you know, investigative techniques. And I was like, this is kind of cool. Maybe I'll look at the center. And then I ended up moving to Alexandria after I graduated. And I was literally blocks away from the National Center. And I was like, all right.
The signs are in order.
Right?
Yeah. And you had multiple roles while you were there. Kind of talk through where you, know, you said you started in the call center and where you ended up. What roles did you have there, and what did you like about them? What made you like, oh, I got to get out of this?
You know, I stayed at the center, the National Center, for 15 years. So I didn't want to run away. That was for sure. It was just a really great place to work, and the people were just pretty awesome. But I started in the call center and I was like, I can't do this for long term. Like, this is going to drive me nuts.
It'll definitely take a toll. Yeah, for sure.
It was like the saddest job I've ever had. But so around, I want to say maybe 2004, the National Center was starting to, focus on increased reporting, in underrepresented communities. And so they started a program that was specifically focused on getting African-American and Hispanic families to report their kids missing, because this wasn't happening. And so they needed someone who understood the dynamics of that. They also needed someone who spoke Spanish, which I do. And so I was like, oh, here's another like a great opportunity for me that's just right here. I'll sign up for this. And so I ended up working in that department, which morphed into a larger education and outreach program over the like the next 10 years. But we were really focused in on outreach to communities, making sure people understood that it was okay to call us if their kid was missing. Because a lot of times, you know, we were battling a lot of misconceptions at the time where people really thought that you had to wait 72 hours before you could report someone missing, which was just not true. And so
they watched too much TV.
They watched too much TV. Yeah. Too much Law and Order, I guess. But like 24 hours would go by. And those first 3 hours that a child is missing are the most critical, and they weren't calling us. And so we really had to do some heavy work in communities to help them understand what the laws were, but also understand what the resources were to bring back kids. And we were really successful in doing that, and started to branch out with other educational content. So we developed a program called NetSmarts, which is an internet safety program that's still used in schools today, focused a lot on abduction prevention. Sexual exploitation, just understanding. Human trafficking was really starting to ramp up in the late 90s and early 2000s. We really focused on that and helping parents understand what the signs were. And so there was just, it was a really interesting job because we were, you know, at Tech, we were really on the ground floor of doing a lot of these things for parents. And it was just something that was a void that needed to be filled. And while, you know, I've had a series of jobs that most people look like, oof, how do you do that every day? Like, it was never like that, except for the first, you know, the call center job. but everything else, like it has so much meaning behind it that it was just fine. And I was able to kind of put everything that I've learned to help families in a really substantial way. And once you kind of make that connection, it's kind of easy to show up to work every day, right? I think that's why people choose nonprofits, because it's just helps you sleep at night.
Got it. So at the Center for Missing and Exploited Children, you actually saw the back end of, you know, the bad side of what happens when things go wrong. So then you move to Atlanta, you go to the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. Now you have the opportunity to put the policies in place to prevent that stuff from happening. Kind of talk through that change and how you use what you learned on the dark side of it to, you know, put the preventive side in.
Yeah, well, it's helpful to see the dark side so you can understand what needs to be prevented. For that role, you know, Boys and Girls Clubs, so large. There's literally a Boys and Girls Club with it. I think there was, there's a map that we had done with like within several miles of like 90% of America, there's a Boys and Girls Club, right? Like they're everywhere. And they really serve a really important function in local communities, whether that's before and after school care, youth development, helping kids to read, getting them through college, learning new skills, like all sorts of things that are integral into youth development. And they had been working on, you know, building out child safety initiatives for years before I showed up, but they needed a new kind of approach, right, where we're looking at more stringent policies, updates to membership requirements, and really getting a handle on what safety looks like in each of the individual clubs. And so having understood and kind of seen how policies can go awry, right, when there are none, or that when things are left unchecked, or when they're not background checks, or when they're not people who are supervising appropriately, it was a natural fit for me to kind of move into that role. And again, it was probably the most stressful job that I've ever had, because there are so many clubs. So you're working across like time zones, and, you know, it's just, there's someone always needs something. But it was just a really fulfilling experience because you got to see the kids that you were helping, right? Like I would go and do site visits, and I would just show up to like a local Boys and Girls Club at like 3:30 in the afternoon. And literally it gave me life, right? After sitting in an office all day, you're like, oh my gosh, you start to think about, man, is this worth it? Yes, it's worth it. Have you seen these kids?
Yeah.
But I'll never forget that there was a little girl who walked up to me and was like, you don't belong here. I had never seen you before. And I was like, you know what? You're right. Thank you for pointing that out. I'm new here. But it just goes to show that club was like on top of making sure their kids knew what the rules were, right? And who was supposed to be there and who wasn't. And it was just affirming.
With an organization that large, and obviously with clubs around the country, did you find that you had to focus more attention in certain areas geographically or demographically than you did in others? And, you know, how did that affect how your policymaking came about?
So I think the first lesson I learned was that every one of them is different. So even though there are 4,300 of them, they all have the same logo, right? Every one of them is run like a separate organization. So within the 4,300 individual clubhouses, there are literally like, I think, 1,100 organizations that served as their umbrella. And then Boys and Girls Club America served as their umbrella. And so everyone had their own CEO and their own board of directors and their own way of doing things. And so it was really helpful to kind of be able to go in and kind of talk to them and understand, like, you know, what are the specific issues that you're having here? Because the challenges that like a local club, let's say in the middle of LA, had versus a club that is in the middle of a small town in Indiana, we're going to be very, very different, right? And their needs were going to be different. And so that really helped shape some baseline policies for us as an organization that gave the clubs the ability to then start to identify areas where they could start to customize, right? You know, we had several clubs had, you know, because they're in the middle of a city, they might have issues with the local homeless population, or they may have a lot of kids being bused from schools to them, or maybe they have kids that are walking, or maybe they have like a huge facility where you've got thousands of kids coming in each and every day, or maybe you only have 14, right? And so all of those things had to come into play with us when we were trying to develop policies, but making them standard enough so that the baseline everybody could reach. And then working with every one of those clubs to help identify the ways for them just to get stronger. And I'll tell you, like, the best safety ideas came from the club. So it was really helpful to see how they were putting things into practice, because a lot of the things that were happening, you know, somewhere out in Wisconsin could be transferred to somewhere in Maryland. And so that was really kind of amazing to see. And honestly, it helped shape my thinking for when I came to the Olympic movement, because you've got another 55 separate organizations with their own CEO, with their own board of directors, with their own initiatives, right? But all having to follow some semblance of the same rules.
So when you were at Boys and Girls Club, what were those issues that were keeping you up at night that you're like, hey, we have to solve this? Because, you know, if we don't, like, we're in trouble.
You know, I think that what kept me at most is that everything I did was I could put a face to a name and a face to a policy. And so it was just like double pressure, because they're like, this isn't just going out either. This is really impacting real people. But you know, there were several active shooter incidents that were happening in and around clubs where we got the clubs to go into lockdown. We had a lot of weather emergencies. So for example, there was a Boys and Girls Club in Joplin, Missouri, right? Which is gone. So those were some of the things that would kind of pop up every day. But the biggest thing, I think, it was just around making sure that the people that we chose to be with kids were properly vetted and supervised. Because at the end of the day, a policy is on paper, right? And how you put that policy into practice is a whole different story. So making sure that those people who were responsible for implementing the policy were adequately trained, knew what to do if they saw something, how to report it, how to stop it, making sure kids were safe. That was largely like, it's individualized, right? You could get someone in there who's sole purpose for joining is to do bad things. My worst fear was that we would let somebody slip through that shouldn't be there, and they would do something terrible. I think that's also why the job was just so stressful, because we had real kids and real families and real communities that we were trying to protect each and every day, even if they didn't even realize we were doing it.
Or if they even asked you to. So,
exactly, yeah. Right?
So jumping from there, you go to U.S. Center for Safe Sport. But before we talk about what you did there, can you give people what the overview of U.S. Center for Safe Sport is? I don't think most people in the U.S. have any clue what the organization is, where it came from, why it's there, that whole backstory. And I think it's a story that needs to be told.
Yeah, sure. I would agree with you. Not everybody knows who we are. We are working to change that. But the center was opened in March of 2017. So we've been open just under 5 years now. And we were open in the wake of the Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics case where more than, I think, 300 women were abused. And finally, that's coming to some sort of resolution, I think. But he was in jail, I think, a few months before we even opened our doors. But what happened then was that the nation realized that sports, particularly those under the Olympic and Paralympic umbrella, really needed to have some consistency across how they interacted and treated minors. And so the Safe Sport Authorization Act was signed into law in 2018, which gave us the authority to have jurisdiction over every one of these organizations. So think about USA Hockey or USA Gymnastics or American Canoe or USA Rugby, the list goes on and on and on. So those organizations fall under the center's jurisdiction for a couple of different things. We were started really to focus in on, three specific areas, and that was really around individual accountability, organizational accountability, and then education and prevention. And when you think about individual accountability, it's probably what we're most known for, and that is investigating allegations of abuse within the sports. So we look at emotional, physical, and sexual abuse and misconduct across the entire movement. And to put that into perspective, at any given time, there are about 11 to 14 million people who are in the Olympic space. So, there's hundreds of athletes that are headed to Beijing in a couple of weeks, or probably this week, actually, for the Beijing Games. We're not just talking about those folks. We're talking about all those kids, all those coaches, all those doctors that are kind of inside the Olympic universe and the pipeline. So if you've got like a five-year-old who is practicing or practicing gymnastics at a local gymnastics gym, the odds are that gym is a member of USA Gymnastics, which would put them under our jurisdiction. And that is very similar to most of the sports.
I do want to make a point for everyone that's listening that this is a federal legislation. So it's federal authority granted to you, not state or local or anything like that. So people understand that like everyone is subject to this rule.
Absolutely. And I think that's an important distinction. So Congress passed the Safe Sport Authorization Act in 2018. They later passed the Empowering Olympic, Paralympic, and Amateur Athletes Act of 2020. It's a mouthful, which further codified our role within the sport. And so in addition to the individual accountability that we're driving towards, and, you know, with that, we, as we investigate allegation abuse, we've got a whole team of investigators here. The center's about, I think we've got about 111 people who work on the staff now. Half of those folks are really focused in on investigations.
Yeah.
And we ban people based on what we find, and permanently removing them from sport, which is something that no other organization in the world does at this time. But the legislation also gave us the authority to develop policies and then audit against those policies for all those organizations. So if you're a local, your kid goes to a local swim club or a local soccer league, you might see the minor athlete abuse prevention policies, you know, that govern the one-on-one contact or the travel policies. Those were developed by the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, and we have the ability to audit against them to make sure that organizations are actually following them, which is a big undertaking, but really necessary because, again, a policy is a policy. It's a piece of paper. And so how we actually use those to protect kids is really important. And so for us, that's a really big piece of what we do that really helps support culture, right? But of course, underpinning all of this is education and training, because at the end of the day, we want people to recognize abuse. We want people to stop it before it happens. But if it does happen, we want people to know where to report it. And so we spend a lot of time and energy developing educational content, some that's required for participants with the Olympic and Paralympic movement, but lots of courses and training content that's for parents and communities, because keeping your kids safe, particularly in a sports environment, goes beyond the Olympic movement, right? This is something that almost every kid in America has participated in some level of sport. And parents should understand how to keep their kids safe. And so we develop a lot of training content that's free specifically for that purpose. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to make culture change, right? Effect culture change within the Olympic and Paralympic movement. And we really believe that with education, with policies, with compliance to those policies, and then rooting out those folks who should not be within sport, we will get there.
Yeah, we actually share your young athlete training with all of our recreational league soccer players. Okay. So we are well aware of that one. Are there any sports that you guys don't have jurisdiction over, or any level of sport?
Well, so, you know, it's the law is very particular to Olympic and Paralympic movements. So we wouldn't have jurisdiction over high school sports. We don't have jurisdiction over, say, the AAU or the NCAA, even though sometimes coaches will kind of travel between an AAU position and like an Olympic or position like that. But the legislation is really clear that, and kind of defines what we can and cannot do. Now, who knows what the future will hold? But right now, I'll tell you, we've got our hands full with the Olympics.
Yeah, because if I remember correctly, that second piece of legislation is kind of what gave you guys your funding. Because I remember you guys were like established as a jurisdiction, but nobody really said who's paying for all of this. So that
Which
second one kind of helped solve
right?
that.
Yeah. Common in congressional mandates, but there's never any money that's associated with it. We didn't have much money. I mean, when we started, we had four staff people, one of which I think was a part-time person. And that first year we got 237 reports, of abuse misconduct. And we had literally a half an investigator, because we just didn't have the funding or the mechanisms to support it. And so the funding, that came through in 2020, provided $20 million annually for us from the Olympic and Paralympic community to support us, which was long overdue and certainly necessary because, you know, 2017, we had four people. Today, we've got 111, and the numbers just keep growing. And, you know, last year, 2021, was the highest reporting year that we've ever seen, and we're in the middle of a pandemic. So we don't have high hopes right now that the numbers will start to decline anytime soon.
Which is unfortunate.
What do you think is the reason for that? Even if we're in a pandemic, theoretically there was a period of time where kids weren't able to participate in sports for whatever reason, yet it was your highest reporting year. What do you account for that?
Yeah, so we saw a dip early in 2020, right when the pandemic hit and people were going into lockdown.
Yeah.
But after that, the numbers just continued to rise. And so, you know, I think part of it is that, you know, every state, almost every county had a different rule around how kids can interact with sport or in school or just in public spaces. So some of that never stopped in some areas. Some of it kept going. I think you also have to remember that there were not one, but two Olympic Games now, right, that are driving this. So the conversation around Olympic sports has been kind of ongoing since Tokyo was postponed from 2020 to 2021. And then during the Games this year or 2021, a lot of athletes were very outspoken about mental health, about abuse prevention. You saw athletes on the Hill. So I think athletes are really driving this conversation, which help others say, you know what, it's okay for me to call them too. It's okay for me to report it because this shouldn't have to happen. So
that's an excellent point. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
What type of challenges do you guys face once you leave the kind of the Olympic sport itself? So if you're not dealing with the Olympic athlete, you know, we talked about U.S. gymnastics was kind of the face of this whole thing. When you get down to the youth level of those, what struggles do you guys have implementing the training programs or the certifications and things like that for, you know, a youth soccer coach in our case?
It's just so big, right? I mean, and USA Soccer is U.S. soccer is one of the largest national governing bodies in this entire movement, with, you know, literally like hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people who are part of that community. So whether you're part of a local soccer team, or you're part of an elite squad, right, or going headed to the Games, you know, it's just, it's really big. And so when you have an organization that's large, that's so large, that also, by the way, has so many local affiliate organizations. So you've got youth soccer over here, you've got adult soccer over here. All of them are having different challenges. So getting them all to understand what's required has been a challenge from the get-go. And it's not, you know, not just with soccer, it's with all the governing bodies, because even though the center has been around for 5 years, people still are, it's new to people, because even people within the Olympic movement struggle to understand who we are and why we do what we do and where we get our authority from and why should I have to do this? And so all these things kind of come into play. And so I think the biggest part is just getting people to understand like why it's important, right? Why it's so necessary. Even if you're an adult who may not interact that regularly with kids, like why you have to take training. And I think the other piece is just, you know, the kids, participants, parents, like they don't have a whole lot of trust in their governing body in some cases. And so, you know, you have an organization that springs up that's supposed to help with kind of rooting out a lot of the terribleness, right, that existed for so very long. It's hard to get people to trust that there's finally going to be a change made. And so we're really struggling with that, to really get athletes and others to trust the process, because to some it's very new. Also, you know, it's not fun, right? Like the issues that we deal with are very serious. They're very private. And many times we have people who have never told a soul what they've told our investigator. And so getting people to get to that point where they're comfortable in doing that will always be a challenge. And it just, it makes it, it just makes it a very like uphill battle to get people to where they need to be. It's happening. But you know, this issue in general is just hard for people to talk about. Nobody wants to talk about sexual abuse. Again, people don't have to talk about anything else.
Maybe except cult, you know, I mean, I'll say one of the pushbacks we get, so we run, we're a massive facility, but we also run a recreational league with about 3,000 kids in it, and it's straight recreational. We don't have a travel program or anything like that, and it's all volunteer coaches, and the biggest pushback we get is time. So, and having gone through Safe Sport, and like that first time you go through it, it's not a short amount of time that you're dedicating to it. And we get pushback from the volunteer coaches, like, I'm just a volunteer. Like, why do I have to do this? Like, it's, you know, I'm just there on Saturdays to coach and that's it.
Or I'm just the assistant coach. I'm just the dad. Like, yeah. I'm not really the main coach. So why do I have to do it type of thing?
Yeah. How do we overcome that hurdle?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it is like, yes, I recognize that the Safe Sport core training can take a little time, right? It's like 90 minutes. I mean, it could probably take up to 2 hours if you're really, you know, intent on it. And we've gotten that pushback from a lot of folks. And what I tell people all the time is, like, this is too important not to spend 90 minutes a year on it. You can literally, I mean, how much time do we spend scrolling our phones on Facebook or, you know, randomly watching things on television that are not really going to give us any sort of like knowledge? We can spend 90 minutes to protect the kids that are in our life. And whether you're a assistant coach or just a dad who volunteers once a month, I mean, wouldn't you want your kid to be with people who understood what abuse prevention looks like? It's too important for us to say that it just takes too long. And I also think about all the other trainings that people are required to take with just like work, right? You've got to take your sexual harassment training. You've got to take the OSHA training. You've got to take like all these things that you are already accustomed to doing. I think that this is just new for people. And it's really hard content. And I think that, you know, we're looking at ways to make it shorter so that we can get volunteers just to more quickly go through this. And we actually just released a 30-minute volunteer course that does that. It doesn't go into as much depth as a core course does. And so that, I think, will help. But, you know, it is a little time consuming. I recognize that. But honestly, I mean, we got 3,700 plus reports of abuse last year. I think that we can spend 90 minutes to take training so that we don't have to see that and that those kids aren't impacted that way, because it was a banner year for us. And that is probably the most depressing thing in this line of work. Our numbers are going up. And so part of that, it could be that people are finally taking education. They know what to report, which is fantastic. But the fact that we're still dealing with this at this level, and I'm not talking about cases that happened 20, 30 years ago, although we do get a fair share of those, we're talking about stuff that happened yesterday. And education is important to getting people to understand what it looks like. Otherwise, we're going to be in a situation just like Mary Nassar, but nobody noticed. And that is the worst thing that we can do for our kids.
And we'll be right back.
Roll by Goodyear, we change your tires, not your plans. Let our mobile van come install your tires wherever or whenever during business hours that you choose. So give Roll by Goodyear a call at 240-907-6461 and mention this podcast for 10% off your tire purchase. Again, that number is 240-907-6461. Roll by Goodyear. Tires on your terms.
Career success starts at Montgomery College. At MC, you can prepare for a rewarding career in biotechnology, business, computer science, or dozens of other exciting fields. And if your goal is earning a bachelor's degree, starting at MC is a smart choice. MC's award-winning team supports you every step of the way. Join the thousands that are getting the education they need to succeed at Montgomery College. Make your move today.
Now back to the show.
I might have to call you and be like, hey, I need a 30-second PSA so we can send it out in the email to our volunteer coaches to kind of just say exactly what you just said. Like, do you want, if you weren't the coach, would you want your child playing for somebody that didn't take this? And I think that kind of message hits home. And I think that would go a long way in getting some, especially the volunteer coaches, to understand why they're doing it.
I'm happy to do that. I also have a whole like studio set up in my house.
And I just thought about this one going kind of one step back when you're talking about the struggles with some of the NGBs, because it's new and getting to understand. Have you guys ever considered looking at, as much as I hate bringing them up, but the NCAA model from compliance, where they basically embed a compliance officer that's trained in whatever this is in a school, you know, maybe think about a safe sport employee staff that's embedded in an NGB. They work in their office to help them get this going and moving and be compliant with it.
So we don't go so far as to embedding people in the staff. One, we'd run afoul of the law. That requires us to be 100% independent from the NGB. So we can't go that far. But what we have done, I guess it helps that a lot of my compliant people are from the NCAA. what we have done is that we've developed a team that not only focuses on audit, but also compliance development. And so each NGB is assigned a person who will work with them throughout the year on whatever issue they may have when it comes to implementing policies, developing them, questions that they may ask, because it is going to be a journey, right? You've got a lot of NGBs and sports organizations who this is their first step into this, right? They've not had to do this before and honestly don't know how. And so the more support we can give them to help get this over the finish line, is going to be really important. So we continue to build out that team to help support that. And we've already seen a lot of success from it. Now putting someone in every, or giving one person to one NGB would probably be a bit much for us just because, you know, that's a huge staff. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that the organization has grown because of it. And, you know, as we think about strategic planning forward, we are looking at expanding that team because that is where I think our culture change is really going to start to take root, right? The more support we can give people on the ground and really drilling down to not at the NGB level, right? But one step further at the local affiliate organizations who are kind of getting information from others and trying to piece things together as best they can. And so that's certainly something that we're looking at as a model down the road. But for that, I have to raise a lot more money. So I'm
yeah, if I can do another recommendation, I think we see this with background checks too, with coaches. We have a lot of coaches that coach multiple sports or across different organizations where they're like, well, I just did a background check here. Can we just use that? And same, I think, with the verifying Safe Sport certification, we have struggles with that too. Like, hey, I took it for, you know, XYZ club that I coach for already. Do I still have to take it here? And we don't have a means to say, hey, okay, you did it over here. How do I check that? So I think that's something that I think we need to move faster on and help us to get compliant.
That is actually almost done.
Okay.
We actually rolled out a new learning management system late last year, where it should be wrapped up by March. And I think some has been migrated, but I have to double check. But that is exactly the point, right? One, to give organizations just greater visibility into who's already taken it. And then to also say, you know, I'm Dries Cologne. I'm a member of track and field. I'm a member of gymnastics. I'm a member of diving, whatever it is. Here's my Safe Sport. So I don't do it over and over again.
Right.
So that part we're tackling right now. The background check is continues to be a mystery.
Yeah.
and you know, it's one of those things that everybody wants to control, like every organization. So if you look at like youth serving organizations that might get volunteers, let's say if you're a girls club and you also volunteer at a YMCA, well, they all both might have different requirements for a background check, right? Like mine may go back 7 years, but theirs may go back 10. So you can't reconcile them. And so youth serving organizations have been trying to tackle that for a long time because background checks are expensive. And if you get people who volunteer at multiple places, you know, and if they are responsible for paying it for themselves, which is often the case, it is a huge deterrent to volunteerism. So I know that's something that a handful of youth serving organizations are trying to tackle right now. Is like, how can we share some of this? But it is one of those things that I wish we would have accomplished like 5 years ago, but it's still in progress.
Yeah, that was what I was hoping when they gave you the enabling legislation, that they added that in, that you're the clearinghouse for background checks as well, because it would make life so easy.
For you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about my life. Because, I mean, even ours, like, and you're talking about different standards. So our standard, we actually have a continual background check. So once you go get in our system, it checks continually. So if anything comes up, because too many times, like, oh, great, you passed your background check in August, but, you know, in January, something comes up, like, I won't know about it till you're required to do another background check. So ours is actually continual. And we all, if soon as something flags, it flags us.
Yep. And I think that's the best route to go. It costs a little bit more. But you know, if you get arrested over the weekend for something nefarious, like the organization gets flagged immediately, you don't have to wait until you do like another background check in 9 months. Right.
Yeah.
That was, I think that's one of the best innovations, I think, in background check technology.
So obviously the University of Michigan or Michigan State and USA Gymnastics was the big thing. And you guys have changed drastically since then. Obviously there's new legislation, you have new funding. How do you see your change from that case to where you are now?
Well, you know, if you think back to USAG, Michigan State and University of Michigan, right? They all very similar, right? Sometimes the same people were involved. I think the biggest change is that there's accountability. If you look back 5-10 years ago, there really wasn't much of that, right? Some sports, some schools, you know, had some requirements around how you interact with kids, especially in the university setting where most kids are 18, right? They're not kids anymore, but there's all these kids that come to camps and all this kind of stuff. There were no rules around that. And so, you know, more universities are putting in place models that look very similar to what the Center for Safe Sport does, right? So around the education and automating policies, making sure background checks are there, but also, you know, keeping tabs on the people that shouldn't be in their ranks. And I think for far too long, universities, sports, religious institutions, you name it, were famous for just passing people around. Once they cause a problem over here, let me just throw you over here. And with the center, you know, one of the reasons why we have the centralized disciplinary database is that if you were banned from USA Swimming, you can't go to USA Diving, right? Like there is a place, a central repository to say, look, this person is not allowed to be around children. This person is not allowed to participate in sport. And so I think that a lot of organizations within the United States and abroad are really looking at how they can take this model and apply it. And I think with universities, it's a little bit more tricky just because you also have the Title IX requirements for schools. But a lot of it is still very similar. There's some, you know, some tweaking at the federal level, but like there's still a lot of similarities as what the requirements are about taking these incidents and these allegations seriously. Things that people would literally throw in a drawer 10 years ago and move on, right? Like that doesn't happen. It can't happen. And if we find out that it does, right, we have to investigate it. And there have been people who have been in these movements for decades who were allowed to just continue to abuse while people look the other way. And I think that what this has shown us is that, like, one, we're not going to take it anymore, right? Like parents, kids, people who are part of these movements, we're sick of that. We demand accountability. And I think that that is something that universities, governing bodies, just the general public is just over it, right? And so I think all of those things were happening at the same time and started to create this shift within schools, within organizations to really make sure that those level of accountability were there and that people were adhering to them and that there are real, people can actually point to real change and instances where people were moved. It didn't matter if you were a high ranking coach or not, right? Because before it was like, well, you know, they took us to the Olympics, they got us a gold medal, so, you know, it's fine, right? Now it's just like, no, it doesn't matter who you are. We are going to hold you to account. And I think that's probably the biggest change since we opened. And that now the public is like looking for it, right? They're like, wait a minute, like this is not okay. So in that respect, I mean, I think it's positive change, but there's still so much more to do. I mean, we've got lots of entities who don't have policies at all that kind of sit outside the Olympic and Paralympic movement, right? You can easily go to any community in America and find an unsanctioned, unlicensed team, right? That's just getting together on the weekends or have people who shouldn't be around kids. And so, you know, the more that we kind of focus on this, I think the more we have the public's attention and the more that people will start to demand that it's things like policies and things like supervision and removing people who shouldn't be there will just be the norm. We're not there yet, right? But I think that we're slowly getting there. And that's largely due to people just being very vocal about it, which, you know, it's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think we definitely come a long way, but in something very close to home for us, like the NWSL, because the Washington Spirit used to play at our facility. Yeah. I mean, and that was across the whole league almost. And you know, it sounded like it was going on for years, and it took still years for them to come forward. So, you know, how do we, you know, expedite this even faster? Because I think the good thing is, I think when it comes out, we're dealing with it much faster. I mean, the Larry Nassar thing, that took years. I mean, we're still finalizing some of that. But I think the NWSL, it came out quick, and they dealt with it pretty quickly. So I think that's the good thing. But how do we get people to come forward faster?
So that has always been a challenge. But I think that the more that we can empower athletes, whatever age they are, to say something and to report, the better we are, right? I think when you look at NWSL, you had athletes coming out and be like, oh my gosh, no. Like, we're not going to stand for this. We're not playing until you fix this. And we're going to tell everybody that you haven't fixed it yet, right? And so they were able to apply pressure, right, very publicly. So, you know, whether or not that had anything to do with NWSL moving faster or not, it had to have some sort of impact, right? I think that, you know, the more people understand that there is a place for people to report, and I think that goes back to your earlier question, Kim, about why the numbers are going up, right? I think it's a big part of it is because people now know that there's a place to go. You know, before 2017, there wasn't. And so it's going to take time, I think, for people to feel comfortable in doing that. But, you know, we are getting a lot of phone calls, a lot of reports from third party bystanders, which tells me that, like, people are recognizing this and be like, nah, that's not cool. Like, I know it didn't happen to me, but this has got to stop. And to me, that is a signal of real culture change within a movement that has largely ignored the abuse of athletes. So it will take time, but the more that we can do things like this, the more that we can actually talk about sexual abuse and what it looks like and how to prevent it and not shame people, right, for coming forward or casting doubt on stories, you know, like, that is when things will start to change. And that is starting to happen. But it is still a very taboo topic. I mean, there are people that just still can't say the word sex, right? And if you can't say that, you definitely can't say sexual abuse. And it's a hard topic for parents to address, right? Because no parent wants to think about their child being abused in some way. And so a lot of parents will just ignore it, right? Because they don't want to talk about it, just like anything else. But, you know, for years, I have likened the conversation around sexual abuse with the conversation around smoking, right? You keep telling your kids is don't smoke, it's bad for you, right? You go give them all this education to talk about this, talk about it openly, right? You need to have those same types of conversations with sexual abuse, right? And about abuse prevention and probably sex in general, but like all these things that parents have just, you know, have trouble talking about, which is why we focus so much of our time on building resources to make it easier. Because again, nobody wants to talk about it. And once you do, it's like, well, shoot, now someone's disclosed to me. What do I do now? Right? People don't know. And so I think that's also something that people have to try to get just more information on. It's like, if somebody tells me something, like, what are my legal responsibilities? Right? Am I mandated a reporter? But also, what should I say to this person who I may be the first person they've told? So we try to walk them through that as well. And the more that we can do that and make it public and help people understand that, I think that we will start to see more people reporting. But I think it also goes back to institutions putting in place these mechanisms for people to do that. Because there's still, I mean, the Olympic community is vast, right? But it still doesn't capture like a significant portion of sports within this country. So we've got to have more people doing more.
Yeah, I also liken it to the discussion around mental health. So I think the younger generation, the kids that are playing today are much more open to talk about mental health. And I think they're much more open to talk about this as well, where their parents are still like, they feel embarrassed or, you know, they don't, even if it's their child that was abused, they don't want to talk about it because they don't want that hanging over their head. Like they did something wrong. I think that is slowly changing, but I think this next generation of kids coming through is going to accelerate that very quickly because they talk about anything. Like there is no filter whatsoever. Like sometimes you need to be like, you need to slow down a little and like maybe not talk about that. It's some of the conversations we hear around here are like, what?
But I mean, it's good, right? I mean, it's that they're so open and free to talk about everything, but you're right. Sometimes I'm like, oof, I did not need to hear that.
I don't need details.
One of the things that we haven't really talked about yet, I think, is like for somebody who does, like, what is the reporting process for some, like, quickly sort of go through that, I guess, if there's somebody who talk a little bit about that, about how that works.
Sure. So we have, you can go to our website, uscenterforstatesport.org, to report a concern. There's a button right on the top right-hand side and on every page on the website. And if you, or if you prefer, you can call us at 833-5-US-SAFE, which is 833-587-7233. And we'll either, whether you do it by phone or if you use the online portal, I'm going to ask a couple of questions. You know, what sport is it? What's the allegation? When did it happen? And you might have all this information, you might have a little bit of it. But we ask that you just call us anyway, and give us whatever you have. Sometimes, people leave their names. Oftentimes they don't. Right? Because we want to make it an environment that is safe. And so if you don't feel comfortable in releasing your information, if you're like a witness to something, you know, we pride ourselves on having a confidential process so that we can handle these things very delicately. Again, recognizing that people, this might be the first time that they're disclosing this to anyone after years, right, of abuse. So it's really simple to use. And then once you make a report, you submit that. And then it goes through our intake team, and then we'll determine whether or not we have jurisdiction. Oftentimes we get reports of like something happened in my kid's middle school. Well, we don't really have jurisdiction over local schools. So we wouldn't be able to investigate, but we would be able to refer the person to where they are. And we would also make a mandatory report just because of our obligations. And so once we determine like the membership of the people involved that make sure we have jurisdiction, we assign that to our investigative team. Our investigators have on average, about 15 years of experience in dealing with sexual abuse misconduct. They come from local, state, and federal law enforcement, military, child protective services. So they've done this for a really long time. So they understand the need to really deliver this and investigate using a trauma-informed approach so that when people go through this process, they're not traumatized all over again. And we keep that with them through the entire process. Sometimes an investigation can take a few days, a few weeks. In some cases, they've taken years. Just depends on how severe these cases are, how complex, how many people are involved. If you think about like a case like Larry Nassar, right? While we didn't investigate that, there's 300 victims, 300 survivors, and probably a ton of witnesses, right? That had to go into that process. And so that takes time. But we really pride ourselves on being very thorough and also being, you know, very neutral in these because, you know, we get allegations of abuse against and by athletes, right? And so we make sure that we treat every one of these cases with the dignity that each of them deserve. So we also have a resource and process advisor, because the process can get kind of complicated just because it's, you know, people liken it to the Title IX process, but it's also has a, you know, because we recognize due process, it has some law enforcement and like criminal justice components. So we have someone to walk them through any questions that they may have.
How tricky is it for you guys, since a lot of these charges would end up in a state court, and you're a kind of a federal, not agency, but federal oversight, that you have to deal with 50 different jurisdictional laws and like statutes of limitations and things like that? How much does that complicate your work?
Oh, it's super complicated.
Is that why you're surrounded by lawyers all day?
Yeah, we surrounded by lawyers all day. Well, it's super complicated because one, a lot of these, sometimes these cases are old and have the statute of limitations has gone, you know, years ago. But let's say that we get a case that there's an allegation of abuse like in 1983, right? Well, while we know that the statute of limitations has passed, we can't apply the laws of 2022 to 1983 case. So we also have to look to see what were the laws at that time in that state, in that jurisdiction, and be able to apply those as well as any sort of codes of conduct that the organization might have had so that we can investigate. Now, there are certain things that will always be investigatable, right? But a lot of allegations of misconduct, because so many states have not yet repealed their statute of limitations, can go on for, you know, it's just a limited amount of time which we have access. What's important, though, is that where the statute of limitations in criminal court, right, whether it's state or federal, have expired, the center doesn't have a statute of limitations. And so we did that on purpose so that people can take their time, right, and you come to us when you are ready to come to us, not fearing that I have a clock that's running out.
Because you can still ban people whether the statute of limitations from a criminal side is gone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not just 0 to 100, right?
Yeah.
Since you had a sport. But the sanctions vary. And, you know, we could sanction you for 2 weeks. We could sanction you for forever.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. How's the pandemic affected you guys? Has it affected, obviously, a lot of your training is online, so I don't think there's too much there. But from an investigative standpoint, when you can't travel places to maybe talk to somebody, how's that affected you guys?
Yeah, we've definitely had to shift some of our operations. You know, most of our staff still works from home. I'm working from my home office right now. Our office is open, but very few people actually go. So our investigations, we do a lot of those virtually. And if, you know, we still do a little bit of travel. So if we need to investigate or need to interview someone who prefers to do that in person, we will try to accommodate that as best possible. But lots of people, because of the pandemic, are much more comfortable doing this virtually anyway. And so we'll use Zoom, to do that. And then we record everything and transcribe everything, which is helpful. And then our education, we did a lot of training on the road. And so we brought a lot of that in-house, not ideal, but certainly fine. I think the biggest thing is for us is that we do audits and we do audits of events. And so we have staff that travel to local events all year long. So if there is an event happening, my team will be out there to do those. And so that has just made things scheduling a little bit more difficult. But I think the biggest thing is that we've just seen, as far as like reports go, a lot more online abuse than we did before the pandemic, because a lot of coaching is taking place online or was at some point. So we're seeing a lot of that. But, you know, we've been able to adjust pretty well. In fact, most of my people kind of like the work from home thing. So we'll see if it stays that way forever. We'll see.
So I know we're running out of time. And I think we told you this in advance, that this whole season is focused on women in sports. And obviously you're not directly in sport, but you're sport adjacent. So we definitely want to get your take on this. So we've been asking everyone the same three questions and want to get your answers for it too. So what challenges do you see for women playing in sports and working in sports?
Well, I mean, I think playing and working, there's always that glass ceiling that forever have been trying to break. I think that it is getting a little thinner, right? And we're seeing a lot of women rise in the ranks of kind of running sports organizations and being decision makers that ultimately impact athletes, which I think is great, but it's just taken a long time. And while I think that we have this momentum during the pandemic, whether it's women or women of color or, you know, like it is something that the nation is sort of like looking at, I worry that just like everything else, the United States in particular has a very short memory. And if once the pandemic rolls around, like leaves, if that ever goes away, that, you know, we will be back to where we are. And I hope that that's not. But it has been really kind of wonderful to see so many women in positions that they probably never dreamt of having 30 years ago. And I think that is probably the biggest thing for us is really just making sure we maintain that momentum to ensure that we get women in places that are making decisions that are impacting not just women, but athletes in general. And every, you know, I follow several female CEOs and sports teams online. And I feel like every day I'm seeing another, like, congratulations to so-and-so, congratulations to so-and-so, because we're actually seeing this more more visible, and women are finally getting to the place where I think that they probably should have been decades ago. So I think that that part is still a challenge for us, and it will continue to be. But I have high hopes for sure, because it has just been remarkable, like just how many women I've been seeing just elevate up the ranks, and myself included, right?
Flip side of that, what advantages do you think women have in working in sports and playing in sports?
Well, I mean, I honestly find that my ability, and this is not to say that men don't, but my ability to just be a little bit more empathetic in times and my leadership style has helped me tremendously. And when I'm dealing with organizations that are led by female CEOs and those and male CEOs, I tend to see a different sort of culture within the organization. And so I think that, you know, for me and for probably many women, we've spent a lot of time trying to work our way up. And like for me, I can, besides investigating abuse, I could probably do every job within my organization because I've had to, right? I've had to prove myself over and over and over again. And when you have to do that, the decisions that you make, the choices that you make as a leader and as you kind of move up throughout organizations have a significant impact on how you lead moving forward. And so I think it's also just recognizing that it's not just 9 to 5 in this office that counts. It's you're taking your staff and the people that you deal with in a very holistic approach, right? And understanding they've got lives outside of what they're doing and taking that into account on how you lead. And I've just found that, and it may be because I just tend to talk to a lot of women that are CEOs, but I'm seeing a lot of similarities there, which I love to see because I think for, especially right now when it's so difficult to find staff, it helps with retention and people just being staying connected to the cause.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Kim and I are laughing internally because we have this imaginary chalkboard on the wall and there's basically three answers that we've gotten to this question. It's been like empathy, attention to detail,
multitasking. Yeah,
like those
1,000 things at one time.
Those are the three answers that everybody that we've interviewed so far have given. It's either empathy, attention to detail, or
I think you guys all colluded to like come up with these answers. So
it's because we've been around the block.
The last question is: what advice do you have for young women that want to work in sports? Obviously, you've taken a very circuitous route to get where you are, but I think some of those life lessons in there could apply to someone that's intent to working in sports.
Yeah. I would say that don't always assume that the traditional route is the only route. You know, I think when you think about working in sports, it's like, oh, I played this sport and so I'm going to get really well at the sport. And then I'm going to go coach this sport. And then I'm going to manage a team. Like that is not, those aren't the only jobs in sport. There are so many other things that you can do to contribute to and work in sport, whether it is finance or marketing or safety. So just understanding and like recognizing that there's so many, like this world is so big that you don't have to do those things traditionally. And I would also say that, you know, and I think a lot of women are really good at this, finding other women in that space that you want to kind of get to where you are. So if you want to be CEO of US Center for State Sport one day, I haven't found anybody who wants that job. Like call me up, right? Like, and don't be afraid to kind of reach out to people who are in positions that you want to have one day. Because I think you'll be surprised at how much time women are willing to give other women to help navigate processes. Because, you know, it took a long time for people to get into the positions they are, but we didn't do it by ourselves. You know, there was always someone who's given a hand up or a leg up. And you've got to be able to recognize those people who are willing to do that for you and take advantage. Because the lessons that I've learned could help you. Maybe they won't. Maybe 10% will help you. But, you know, for me, I pride myself on finding people who want to move up in the world and helping shape them and being a mentor, because there are lots of things that I did when I was like 25 and I'm like, what was I thinking? Somebody should have just told me and pulled me aside, like, don't wear that or whatever it was, right? Like, but I just don't be afraid to ask for some insight, because, you know, I know a lot of people who are just waiting to get it.
Well, I can't thank you enough. We've taken more time than you allotted for us, and want to be respectful of that. So thank you again for doing the show, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Pitch Side from the Plex podcast is supported by SAM Soccer. SAM Soccer provides developmental and educational soccer programs in Montgomery County. SAM offers classes, clinics, and leagues for children 2 to 18. All league games are home games at SAM Soccer, offered at the prestigious Maryland Soccer Plex. Check out samsoccer.org for more information.
So if I didn't know any better, I think we were like an actual professional podcast with like real guests now. So
yeah,
it's getting much more serious, and I think
informative, yeah, and good for people to listen to. Absolutely.
I am glad you asked the question to explain the reporting thing, because
yes,
I didn't even think about, like, we're, yeah, talking about how people don't know what they are or what they do, and then forgot to ask.
Well, like, and for somebody who might be scared to how this process works, like, it's better to be to understand how it all works so that you don't have to be fearful of the process should you ever need to use it, which hopefully no one listening to this podcast ever needs to do that. But should it happen, there you go.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine working in that call center at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Kids.
Nope.
Like that.
That definitely would take a toll. And I could not do that either.
Yeah, I always tell Jess, like, leave the child custody cases at home, because that's what she deals with. And I'm like, I definitely don't want to, like, hear that every day. Like, no. I can understand why people get burned out, and she was like, I can't do this and need to move to do something else. Like,
yeah,
that's rough.
For sure. But there was another tally for the empathy column.
Yes. We really do need to put the scoreboard up.
Yeah.
There
is three very consistent answers at this point. Empathy, yes, multitasking, and attention to detail, for sure.
I still think you guys all colluded and got together beforehand.
Listen, like I said, it's because we've all been there. We've all been through it, and we all know our strengths at this point.
Got to do what you got to do.
Exactly.
So her journey was interesting because, obviously, like I said, it's sport adjacent. I mean, it's working in sport, but it's not governing a sport or playing or it's
a different side of it, yeah, but it's a necessary side. Part of it.
Yeah. It's crazy, like, that came about in 2018.
I thought, for some reason, I thought that they might have been around a little bit longer, like just before the Larry Nazar case, but maybe not.
I think it was a result of that case.
Yeah.
So,
that's very clear now, but I guess in my head I was thinking that it existed before that, just because I thought this can't possibly be the first time somebody thought of this, but
yep.
But yeah, I think this was a very informative episode for sure. And I think it was good for people. Like you said, it's sport adjacent. It's like a necessary part of it. And anybody who participates in youth sports needs to know about this.
I mean, they have a monster task too. I mean, I think, like she said, like soccer alone, like how large,
yeah,
U.S. soccer is, and every subcategory, U.S. youth, U.S. club, like every, that, how many kids play soccer? I mean, even what, Maryland's 200,000 kids play soccer or something, mm-hmm, like that, whatever the number is, like multiply that by 50. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of kids just in one sport,
yeah,
to deal with. So
and then swimming and all of that, like,
yeah. I mean, yeah, think of how many baseball players there are and softball players there are, and
yeah,
how many coaches that is. And that's a lot of training. And as much as I give U.S. soccer and U.S. youth and all those subcategories like a hard time, at least they're organized, like, mm-hmm, dealing with some of the other sports. Like, there's no like top down organizational structure when it gets to the youth level. It's just the wild, wild west and utter chaos. Like, they don't even know what coaches are coaching. I mean, they have a long way to go to kind of get there. So,
but, yeah.
And that was what she was talking, like, you know, they have made strides, but, you know, you do look at the NWSL, like, that happened last year.
Yeah.
On the professional level. I mean, and when you start reading the stories, it's been going on for years and, like, still don't have people reporting, and not just the people it happened to, but people that know it happened and still didn't say anything.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that although, like, the pandemic has changed things so much that this has actually been their like highest reporting year. I mean, that's depressing on so many levels, but that's also, I mean, I think it's a double-edged sword. It means A, people are becoming more educated about this and how to report it. Hopefully that's what that means. But then B, like, you know, people are speaking out more.
I also can compare it to the beginning of the pandemic when it didn't look like it was that bad. And then once we had tests available, like, the numbers skyrocketed
because, that's true,
you know, then we had the means to report And I think this is some of that. So we now have the means to report. And she said it too. Like, people now know what to do.
Yeah. So that's a double-edged sword. Like, hopefully that means it's a good thing, because there's more, like you said, people are know more, so they're reporting more.
It's like the social, hopefully like that social also media means
that we can start to bring it back down, because people are reporting.
It's like the effect social media had on things. Like, all this stuff has been happening for years, but now people have a camera in their pocket and they can record it.
Yeah.
So it just seems more prevalent now, but it's always been happening. And, it, you know, I don't want to say always will. There will always be some piece of this. Hopefully we can just get the numbers back down. But we'll see a spike for a while as people learn how to report and feel more comfortable reporting.
Mm-hmm. I also liked your advice that it doesn't have to be the traditional path to work in sports. That this is something, again, this is a necessary piece of this. So if this is something that somebody, you know, an avenue that somebody wants to take if they're looking to work in sports, I think this is a definite good option for that.
Yeah, I don't know if I would take this route, because – man, that
special type of person, but
When she joked, she hasn't found anybody that wants to replace her yet. Like,
well, I mean, I have friends who are social workers, and I could never do what they do, but they have the skill set that allows them to be great at that job. So there are people out there who this is something that they could be great at.
So I'm glad we did the interview, and glad she agreed to talk with us.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, all right. Anything else?
That's it for me.
All right. Go back to work.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Pitchside from the Plex podcast. Head to mdsoccerplex.org to listen to old episodes and view episode notes. Follow us at mdsoccerplex on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Be sure to join us again soon. Pitchside from the Plex is produced by Matt Libber and Kim Walter, with support from Alexis Andricat-Price and Gary Burke.